Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hello and welcome to Vulgar History, a feminist women's history comedy podcast. My name is Anne Foster and I slightly have a cold, but that's not stopping me from sharing this episode with you today. It's an author chat with author Emran El-Badawi. So his book, Queens and Prophets, How Arabian Noblewomen and Holy Men Shaped Paganism, Christianity, and Islam, has just come out. You can purchase this wherever you get your books from. It's such an interesting read, and I loved this chat that I had with him where we talk about his work and his research and how do you even go about researching things from that long ago, and where was ancient Arabia? What were the years, and what geographically, where is it? Anyway, I hope you really enjoy this chat, because I really enjoyed having this chat with Emran El-Badawi. Okay, so I'm joined today by Emran El-Badawi. Welcome. We're here to talk about your book that is just coming out. Can you please tell us first about yourself and your work?
Good afternoon, Annabelle. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, so as you mentioned, my name is Emran El-Badawi. I am chair of the Department of Modern and Classical Languages at the University of Houston in Texas in the United States. I'm also director of Middle Eastern Studies and the co-founder of the International Quranic Studies Association. And my areas of research are typically the Quran and late antique Arabia, including, you know, Quran and Bible, post-biblical literature, especially in Syriac, and even classical Islam and you know, classical Arabic and Islamic literature, written, of course, in Arabic. And I also have a secondary interest in modernity in the Arab world, looking at issues of liberalism, gender, sustainability. So, and I consider myself a citizen of the world. So. There you go.
So what era are we talking about here?
Yeah, so this book, Queens and Prophets, my most recent one, looks at late antique Arabia. So in terms of time, you're looking at roughly the 2nd to 7th century. Late antiquity, of course, is a term that's coined by Peter Brown and other sort of historians that have really given us this gift of looking at history in this way. It's the time when sort of Rome and Persia are sort of tearing each other apart and before the rise of Islam. So it sort of falls through the cracks typically. So this period of late antiquity in Arabia is incredibly interesting. And when I refer to Arabia, so if I could talk about geography for a minute, it includes what we would say is greater Syria, including Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, and the Arabian Peninsula, including the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Councils, you know, Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Gulf cities, I'm sorry, states. And then, of course, the book itself touches upon the history and geography of other neighboring Near Eastern and even European Mediterranean provinces and countries like Egypt, Iran, Ethiopia, Turkey, and even Balkan Europe. So I'm hoping that the book is relatively comprehensive in its approach.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I really wanted you to clarify that right off the bat in this podcast, because these are some of the oldest civilizations on Earth, right? Like this area, there's so much history in like everything you were just describing, Syria and Egypt and that whole area. And so we know what those countries are called now, but the period of time you're talking about, so you mentioned the Persians, for instance. So you're looking at numerous different dynasties, certainly different cultures, ethnicities, religions, but they're all, you can phrase it as just sort of ancient Arabia, and that encompasses everything that you're talking about.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting question, and it's part of an ongoing debate among scholars, and it's not resolved. So what I try to do, of course, you have the book, so you'll know at least through exposure that in the first chapter, I try to argue what is Arabian society. It's a term that I need to define. I also talk about terms like Arab, Saracen, and Ishmaelite. So by all means, when I say Arabia or Arabian society, we're not talking about necessarily one, you know, ethnic group or haplogroup or even one language or one religion. But what I'm arguing, of course, and it's not just me, I'm building on earlier scholarship, that over the course of late antiquity, the people of what I define as Arabian society, this conglomeration of empires and trade networks and, you know, warring clans and tribes, that they come together into a complex of Arabic language and culture. And that takes place prior to Islam. There is a contiguous, perpetuated through history, an entity that we can call Arabia. You can sort of hold it with your hands. I say that because this is something that is vehemently argued against by a lot of hyper-revisionist, hyper-skeptical colleagues of mine, you know, who argue that there is no Arabia prior to Islam. And in fact, there may not even be any Arabia prior to the Abbasid dynasty, which ruled roughly 750 till about 1250 or 1258 with the influx of the Mongols. And that, to me, is an untenable position for so many reasons. And it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. This book is, it's about female power in pre-Islamic Arabia, but it's also about Arabia, period.
So, I mean, that brings us beautifully to how you came to write this book. You talk about it, I think it's in the introduction of the book, that not on purpose, I think is how you say it's kind of an accident you came upon this topic. Can you explain about how that happened?
Yes, of course. So, I wrote this book by accident, and it sounds, I know, a little bit maybe quaint and maybe a flippant comment, but it's not meant to be. It really is. There are a couple of dimensions to this. One, of course, is, you know, over the years, I myself, every scholar evolves over time. We change as human beings, we change as scholars. And, you know, I was trained I'm a scholar of text. I read texts in Arabic, in Syriac, in Aramaic, and, you know, Arabian dialects, Greek. And you tend to sort of just mine the sources and interpret them and, you know, reflect what they say in a modern context. And over time, I started to get a little bit jaded, and some of my female colleagues, I have to give credit, the importance of women, female agency, and power did start to influence me. So I just was, you know, sort of one day doing what scholars do, researching a book, writing a book on holy men in Arabia. And I happened to stumble across what I'd like to call, you know, like their bosses. And many of whom seemed to be women of high standing. And I thought that was fascinating. I thought that was a story that has not been told, and I have to do it. So I, you know, sort of veered a little bit away from just merely mining the sources, which is just, you know, we'll look at our sources and just say what they say and, you know, go into hyper, you know, granular detail about, is this a biblical reference? Is this a Quranic reference? Is this a rabbinic reference? Which is good, but doesn't go far enough. Well, what about who are the historical actors that are not being mentioned in the sources? And I'll mention one last thing in this regard. So I'm not alone, of course, in doing this. There's been a move in, I would say, certainly in the past decade, but even past decades, to move away from old-fashioned, you know, royal histories and ecclesiastical histories and world histories, which is reflected in the sources. They're very, very useful. But to move towards more cultural and popular histories and even anthropological and social science or histories that are imbued with the social sciences, which of course I learn from, which are of course more bottom up. So that's also part of the picture. And I'll cite two examples of that. There's of course Hani Khafipour and Jack Tanous have recently written, of course, these sort of popular cultural histories on the Middle East. And I'm just, you know, I feel like we need to take it a step further now. Well, let's look for the women now.
No, and that's a lot of what I'm doing with this podcast as well. It's really kind of finding in the margins of other people you read about in history. It's like, oh, wait, but who is that woman that you mentioned that you're pulling a thread? And so you talk about, I think it was also in the introduction of your book, you describe it almost, it's not strictly an academic research process. You describe it as storytelling, partially, right?
Yes. So absolutely. And I must say, I also really love the name of your podcast, Vulgar History. It's really awesome. But storytelling in this book that I have recently contributed is, and it gives us as scholars and as, historians, a way out. Rather than sort of, recreating or remaking the sausage over and over again, instead of debating, does Arabia crystallize before or after Islam, what happens if we actually start telling stories and let the stories guide us? So that's something, again, what I describe as narrative history. And, if I can combine my specialization as a philologist and borrow tools from storytellers, what do we learn? And by way of example, one small thing that we learn by writing a book in this way or reading it is we learn that storytelling, especially, for example, ecclesiastical histories that were written for the Byzantine or, the Greek-speaking church in late antiquity, or world histories written for the caliph, who then was the most powerful man on the planet in Baghdad, right? These histories were written not merely or not fundamentally to serve as truth for us, 1,000 years later to just mine. Mm-hmm. They are actually written to share stories and build a communal identity. That's what made you Christian. It's what made you Muslim. So when you start to look at sources that way and you start to treat your sources as these entities and texts and partners that build identity rather than, arguing about truth and authenticity the whole time, you're able to actually say a lot more and, explore different perspectives and find, what I would describe, the female agency and the female power, which I, of course, discuss at length in the book.
I was wondering if you could give an example of one of the women who you write about in the book.
Oh, yes, of course. So a brief introduction is, of course, the book itself has, roughly maybe two parts. What I describe, I talk about pagan queens, so pre-monotheistic era queens of Arabia. And then I talk, of course, about believer queens. And the language is a little bit ambiguous on purpose. So among, of course, the believer queens, there are three who are a really big deal. I talk a little bit about Zenobia, and I talk about Mavia, and I talk about Khadija, or Khadija, the wife of Muhammad. So, I might say something about Zenobia since she's the first. Of course, she is described by historians as the most romantic figure of, the Roman and Oriental Near East. At the same time, she's sort of mysterious, and nobody really knows, the historical Zenobia that well. But why is she important? Why did I talk about her? Because she's the Empress of Arabia. She's of Arabian, Syrian, Oriental extraction, something that, of course, we debate. And what I'm bringing to the fore in this book is that she fostered a holy man called Paul of Samosata, who is a bishop, he's an important guy in the church, and that they contributed to the articulation and even the remnants of alternate doctrines within the church. Of course, I make a big deal, of course, here about heresies and the church and how they should be viewed we should view them more critically rather than just heresies, to look at how the dimensions of race, class, and gender play a role. And another thing, of course, is that Zenobia is remembered. Her legacy is enormous in Roman and Arabian traditions for centuries. So she's such a big deal. I argue, of course, the employer of Paul, and that Paul, he's accused of adoptionism and other, weird religious practices. But that, it's, again, I'm just looking at a node in a long string, and that if we follow along what comes before him and what comes after him, it does take you to Christianity in Arabia. It takes you to Islam in Arabia. It takes you to the Quran, to Muhammad, the details of which are found in the book. So hopefully your listeners will buy it.
Yeah. Well, no, and it's interesting to me because in terms of Zenobia, who's a figure I haven't covered on the podcast yet, but what I mostly have heard about her is she stood up against Rome. She's this warrior figure, and you're exploring other facets of what she wasn't just that.
Absolutely. And of course, thank you again for introducing that. I mean, she is fundamentally known as, she's the empress who stood against Rome and paid for it with her life. that's still very important in the book, but you know, we want to go deeper. And if you do go deeper, you know, what can we say? A couple of things. You know, she's described, of course, in the sources as an illustrious queen, as Augusta, which is the highest ranking title you can have. You know, this is, of course, in the Roman world, as the mother of the King of Kings. And that, of course, that title covers the Persian sphere. So, and I argue one thing in the book is that she sees herself as the queen of the earth. Now, sounds kind of grandiose, but that's what men said about themselves all the time after Alexander the Great, right? So, and one last thing, of course, is, you know, within Arabic and even Islamic tradition, there are traditions of Al-Zaba. This is a strange name, Z-A-B-B-A, with a doohickey at the end. This sort of pre-Islamic queen of the Arabs. So they recognize that there's this queen of all Arabia and that, you know, this is, it's Zenobia. And that she fights against the leper king of Al-Hira. Al-Hira, of course, is this city-state in Mesopotamia, which became, of course, the capital of Christianity prior to Islam. And then you have, of course, the name Zainab. Zainab, of course, is a common name even in, you know, today among Arabs and among Muslims. But we have four Zainabs, two of which are the wives of Muhammad and two of which are, you know, his progeny, his daughter and his granddaughter. And again, those are echoes of Zenobia. So she really is a big deal. And she's been written out of history as much as she's been recalled.
And now we're just going to take a break for a word from our sponsors.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
And we're back. No, so I really appreciated that you were expanding upon, and I guess your ability to read all these different languages and to look at the different sources combined with the approach you're taking of the storytelling really helped to put together, even just saying that this is what people had, and it was spelled differently, like to put that together, like, well, they mean her, you know? So then being able to add, well, here's what other people were saying about her.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, because you know it's important for us as scholars and as historians, as philologists, as critics, as social scientists, to have imagination, to think and have thoughts, and to dig deep. And we do dig deep, but I think there's sometimes an emphasis on not going far enough. And I think that there is a need for us, there's a need for imagination, especially if you're looking for to write a sort of a cultural history, to tell stories about marginalized, about today marginalized populations, then you need to actually use imagination, and you need to actually go a little, you take the data as far as you can. And I think, again, it's not that hard to do. We just have to, you know, want to do it.
It's just so fascinating to me, because what you're looking at is such ancient text. You know, so a lot of the research I've been doing has been, I don't know, 1600s, 1800s, where you have stuff is written in English. I'm able to, there's a lot of points of view, but you're looking at what pieces of paper remain from that period of time. And you have to piece it together almost where you really need to bring the imagination to just turn that into a story if all you have is one scrap of, I don't know, papyrus or something.
Absolutely. And to go back again to connect what we just said, you know, to the both points, this one and the one earlier, scholars do use imagination whether they admit it or not. Because when you're looking at, you know, epigraphic evidence from Arabia, like, you know, scribbles on rocks, most of which are funerary, you know, this is this funerary site of so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so, whoever touches it is cursed by the god so-and-so. You know, it's like a formula. When you look at thousands of these and you start piecing them together, you have to use imagination as well to make those connections. Or, of course, when you're looking at literary evidence, when you're looking at books, some of the stuff that you're mentioning just now, whether those books are written in Arabic and come from the 8th or 9th century, or you know, Syriac Christian or Rabbinic Aramaic sources from earlier, you know, 3rd, 4th, 5th century, or Greek sources prior to that, it's to connect all of them. First of all, it's a ton of work, right? Mm-hmm, it takes a lot of training and toil, but it takes imagination. And I don't think that it's wrong to actually, you know, articulate that. And, you know, I think that that's something I've sort of put forth in the book boldly, and hopefully it works.
Well, and you said, again, I promise I read the whole book. I keep mentioning things from the introduction, but it's you really set up everything in there. And one of the things you mentioned was that some of your colleagues challenged you in this concept, or thinking like you were doing some sort of Arabic version of the Da Vinci Code or something. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So writing this book has been exceptionally difficult. I have to say that, you know, up till writing this book, I've been spoiled as a scholar. I've enjoyed my privilege as a man, as an Arab and Muslim American, as a, you know, a scholar of the Middle East. I've just enjoyed that, you know, I write my scholarship, I send it for peer review, I get constructive feedback, and it's published. This is the first time I have gotten so many rejections. It has been flabbergasting. Part of it was, of course, you know, you get feedback, and they've all helped me. But there's something amiss, you know. It gave me pause. I'm like, why is everyone so, you know, antagonistic? And why is there so much animosity to what I'm writing? So I think that there is something to be said about, you know, just, you know, existing power structures and scholarly bias. And we're all human beings at the end. So it took extra work to articulate my ideas. And I think that it is a better work. I'm thankful to, again, my detractors and my supporters alike. I had to be extra rigorous. I had to go, you know, do my due diligence. And I know still the book as it stands now, some folks will be very happy about it. Other folks won't be convinced. But there's one point I wanted to mention, of course, which we all have to sort of admit or acknowledge is, you know, pre-Islamic Arabia is a very mysterious place. And there are no books in pre-Islamic Arabia. The first book is the Quran, which of course is this masterpiece of Arabic language and religion. And it's like, how did this happen, right? So that is a problem for anyone who wants to write about pre-Islamic Arabia, is you don't have sources. So you have to be extra creative and go really wide and look at neighboring civilizations. And now we have, of course, more epigraphic sources and more of the, you know, Syriac Christian sources are being, you know, extrapolated and interpreted. So it makes things a little bit easier. We're getting there. And I think that I hope that this book changes some opinions and changes how some, honestly, how some scholars behave.
Well, because you're looking at historically, like, I'm going to say nearly every historical society is a patriarchal society. Like, the instances of women being powerful are so rare that, you know, they stand out. So to be, is that part of the challenge, is looking at these structures that have been accepted as patriarchal societies and saying, well, actually, here's the influential women who were there. Is that part of what the pushback was?
So that's definitely part of it. And I'm also sort of ruminating on your question, but I'll add that this book builds, of course, on numerous colleagues who happen to be female and also writing about Arab women. So among them, of course, is Leila Ahmed, last name Ahmed, who is a towering figure in Islamic gender studies. She acknowledges, she acknowledges the point that you made, which is all sort of society is patriarchal. It's like, what could all the men on the earth agree upon, that they're in charge? At the same time, she's acknowledging that especially in pre-Islamic Arabia, you had these communities and instances where you have matrilineality and pockets of matriarchal, customs. And those, of course, if we ever get a chance to discuss it now or maybe even later, I discuss in future research. It's already written and I'm working on it now. But scholars understand that nuance is king, right? It's so important because history is never linear, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And what ends up happening, especially in pre-Islamic Arabia, is you have patriarchy and matriarchy. You have men in charge and women in charge. And that's not conceptually easy to understand or communicate. So we get lazy and say, okay, well, this is the one narrative we're going to stick to the whole time. Mm-hmm. The reality is you have large or widespread, long-lasting patriarchal structures. I discussed them, of course, in the final chapter. But nestled between them, among them, before them, and after them, almost in perpetuity, are matriarchal structures and polities that, where you have queen regents and women. And again, the importance, again, of priestess and goddess, they get lost in these, our typical notions of, what is power? Well, power is a king or it's a president. Well, what about the priestess? What about the priest? So we have to do both the nuance of acknowledging that you have men in charge and women in charge, and that you also have to look at different categories of power. And by, sort of walking and chewing gum, hopefully, this works out and it tells us a new story about pre-Islamic Arabia.
Well, and something that I come across in my research as well is, especially when you're going really far back, if there's not a contemporaneous account, then you're reading what somebody 500 years later thought, and they're bringing their point of view from 500 years later, or 1,000 years later, 2,000 years later. So trying to break down, well, this person thinks this, but that's because this is what was happening in his world. But 500 years ago, is that what was really happening? So it's just trying to take away the bias of people reporting far after the fact what actually happened at the time.
Yes, great point. Because this of course is the other problem. Of course, so we mentioned, of course, that there are no good sources or no immediate sources for pre-Islamic Arabia. They're slowly coming out, but still, it won't be anything not too verbose in its content. So what do we have? We have, in fact, literary sources which come centuries after the fact. Mm-hmm. So we have lots of texts and stories, and histories about pre-Islamic Arabia and men and women that come 200, 300, 400, 500, 600 years after the fact. And, they tend to fall into these tropes and topoi, sort of biblical and Roman way of looking at the world where men are in charge. And it sort of tells the story of Arabia in those terms. So you have two challenges. One, you have to try and extrapolate or dig out the nuggets of truth or the kernels of truth. Sometimes, and again, there's a lot of debate about that. Sometimes there's none, sometimes there's some. The second thing you have to do is read against the text, because the content itself, so if you're, Sazaman of Gaza, writing your ecclesiastical history, and you're talking about these Arabs in Palestine and Sinai and North Arabia, and you're saying that they worship in this way and that you know, that they're sort of, they're worshiping abominations or something of that nature. Yeah, that's what he's saying, because he's a churchman and he wants to promote Christianity in his day. So you have to read against it. Oh, well, that there were, you know, the majority of the population were another religion, and this is what they were worshiping, and there was this intrusion of, you know, Christianity into the picture. So anyway, that there are a number of challenges, but if we as scholars do the work, it is not impossible.
This is going to be possibly a very big question, which is maybe not the best choice. It's like, let's wrap it up with this question. But you touched on this a bit in the book, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are today about the connection between this book and the women you discuss and the societies and cultures you discuss and today, current situations for women, especially in that region of the world.
Yeah. So yeah, that is a big question.
I know. And,
I will preface by saying a couple of things. One, of course, is I am ultimately, you know, a humble man in this world who's trying to learn from his colleagues, both female and male. And I've learned a lot writing this book, not just researching it, and even getting feedback from my colleagues and my students and my friends and family. A couple of things I think if we can learn, you know, what are the lessons maybe of this book as far as the contemporary world? There are a few. So one, of course, is it realigns our assumptions about what monarchy is. So if you Google the word queen, right, or king, you know, you might get the Queen of England, who left us not too long ago, right? May she rest in peace. Why is that the case? When we, you know, when we think about monarchy or queenship, that we think of, you know, we think about the English royal family. Why, when we think of, for example, it also realigns our assumptions when we think about God or divinity or about power away from, I would say, European models or Eurocentric models. I just gave one quick example to older examples that come from Arabia and I would even say the ancient Near East. So, you know, by way of example, there's a long tradition. It's not as well attested, but of queenship in Qatar and the UAE and the Arabian Peninsula. Those are, of course, very new states. They were, you know, founded just decades ago. But they are heir to this tradition that I've been, you know, writing about. So that's one. Another one would be how we think about religion and politics today. So, for example, here in America, I would say, at least in the United States, I don't know about Canada, but, you know, the emphasis on God and country is first and foremost shaped by gender, race, and class. And it sounds maybe kind of, you know, quaint for me to say that, but I mean, it's fundamentally shaped by men saying, this is how things are. And there's nothing wrong with that if you know that that's what's happening, but we don't know that's what's happening. So again, it challenges our assumptions. It forces us in, you know, out of our comfort zone when we think about religion and politics, that this is how men have told us things are. And we've had to write out, you know, women and minorities, whatever that means, and poor people, and in order for us to privilege ourselves and see ourselves as God and presidents and so on and so forth. So that's the second thing. Another one would be modern women are not the first to enjoy freedom. And the burden of independence. And I say that both because being free can suck sometimes, right? And not just out here celebrating for no reason, whether you're a man or woman. But women today are not the first to do that. So whether we talk about women in, you know, the Western world or the Arab and Islamic world, you know, the human beings today are educated and literate at record rates. That, of course, is new to history. But it's not new that women exercise agency and were heads of state and were the wealthiest women in the entire city. That's happened before. And it's actually kind of shocking when we read about pre-Islamic Arabia, and this is in the book, of course, just how independent, how free, how wealthy, how powerful these women were. And of course, that challenges our assumptions. And one last point to try and wrap up this really big question is, I mentioned, of course, the Iraqi-American activist Zainab Salbi at the end of my book. And she talks about, you know, women are the ones who are there at the end. And if I can quote her for a second, it says, like life, peace begins with women. We're the first to forge lines of alliance and collaboration across conflict zones. I say that because we're in a world where war is just the natural state of things. Why is that? Why is that the case? It wouldn't hurt to, I think, put women in actual, in original places of power. And I mean that, you know, to challenge the idea that, you know, women CEOs is a marker for something. I said, I think that's a little bit different. But to, when we look at the example of Maivia, that, you know, she did things on her own terms. She antagonized the Roman emperor, the, you know, the bishops. She did everything her way. That we need a little bit more of that in our world today. And not a sort of rebellious childishness, but I mean, at the very, very top. I mean, our world, I think, needs it.
That just connects to something else I just remembered I wanted to bring up with you. On the dedication page, I just love this. It's a poem or a quote about chess is a game of life.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have it in front of you, but I do, so I can read it. Just on your dedication page, it says, chess is a game of life. The queen is the most powerful piece on the board. Respect the queen, win the game. I have it in front of me because I just took a screenshot and saved it because I was like, that's so beautiful.
You know, I always get emotional when I think about that dedication because, of course, I dedicated it to my kids. And my kids, I have three boys. They're all young men. And, you know, the quote itself is sort of an adaptation of a very famous quote from a chess player. And my kids all grew up playing chess. And they still do. And I want them to grow into the men that I would want them to be. And I want them to be better than me. And in order to do that, you have to respect the queen on the board.
Mm-hmm. It just really took my breath away when I just first opened your book. I was like, oh, that's, I took a screenshot of it. I think I saved it. I put it on Instagram or something. I'm just like, this is so beautiful. And it really speaks to I don't know, clearly your personal philosophy that really is shown throughout the book that you've written.
Thank you. I mean, I myself, I mean, that's my favorite passage in the whole book is actually the dedication.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah. No, it's honestly saved on my phone right now. If people want to keep up with you, do you have social media or a website or anything where people can follow you and see what you're up to?
Yes. So all of the above. Of course, you can Google my name, and I'm sorry to say it that way. It sounds sort of shameless publicity, but you could do that. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook, although I limit, of course, my, you know, the friends I accept. But Twitter is where I am most active, and you know, I also have an academia.edu page where I share samples or whole parts of my research.
No, that's so good, and I can put links to all of that in the show notes. So thank you so much for joining me to talk about this really good book.
Thank you so much, Annabelle, for having me. I really appreciate it. You are now, I hope, a part of this story, and I'm indebted.
So again, the book we were talking about is Queens and Prophets, How Arabian Noblewomen and Holy Men Shaped Paganism, Christianity, and Islam, which is out now by Emran al-Badawi. I'll put all of his links for his social media and things in the show notes so you can follow him and see what he's up to because his new stuff he's working on also sounds really interesting. And if you want to keep up with me and this show, so we are on Instagram at Vulgar History Pod, on TikTok at Vulgar History. If you want to reach out to me for any reason, there's a form at vulgarhistory.com or you can email vulgarhistorypod@gmail.com. You can also support the podcast /me on Patreon at patreon.com/AnnFosterWriter. So if you pledge at least $1 a month, you'll get early ad-free access to all of our new episodes. If you pledge $5 a month, you get access to bonus episodes of Vulgar Peace Theater, where I talk about costume dramas with friends of the podcast, Allison Epstein and Lana Wood Johnson, and also episodes of So This Asshole, where I talk about awful men from history. And you can shop for Vulgar History merchandise at vulgarhistory.store, where you can always use code TITSOUT for free US shipping or TITSOUT10 for 10% off. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week with another episode. And until then, keep your pants on and your tits out. Vulgar History is hosted, written, and researched by Anne Foster and edited by Christina Lumagi.
Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that, as well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.